This is Doug Gillard of Guided by Voices, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC, Accra.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Mid-Hudson Cable, serving Columbia, Greene, and Southern Albany counties with digital cable, high-speed internet, and cable phone services for homes and businesses since 1971. Mid-Hudson Cable, all the right connections on the web at mhcable.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Food New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. I'm Philip Grant. On June 3rd, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison upgraded charges against a former Minneapolis police officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck and charged the other three officers at the scene with aiding and abetting murder. Protests, though, continued nationally and in the Hudson Valley. The Daily Freeman reported that more than 1,500 people turned out for Walk for Black Lives in Kingston, starting at 5 p.m. at Academy Green and marching down Broadway in a show of solidarity against racism and for police accountability. The Hudson Valley chapter of Citizens Action of New York organized the event. Rashida Tyler of the Real Kingston Tenants Union said during the event, and I quote, "We're here today of all colors. Remember this moment when anyone tries to be divisive and say, black this, white that. We can't come together. We can, we will. We're moving forward," end quote. Kingston also hosted a smaller protest July 30th. Kingston Mayor Steve Noble, Ulster County Executive Pat Ryan, Ulster County District Attorney David Clegg, and Kingston Police Chief Egidio Tente were among the politicians in attendance. Almost all protesters wore masks, but few were able to maintain 6 feet of space with one another. There are more protests scheduled in the region this week, with one in Catskill meeting at 5 p.m. at the middle school on June 4th. The Troy Rally for Black Lives will be held at 2 p.m. June 7th at Riverfront Park. This is the first protest in that city since the murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police, and the Times Union reports that Troy officials are preparing for the worst. Kenneth C. Crow II reports, and I quote, "Law enforcement sources said the Troy Police Department's riot gear was brought out of storage to the station," end quote. Several law enforcement officials refused to comment. Rensselaer County Executive Steve McLaughlin said at his daily coronavirus update that, and I quote, "We expect, I think, that's a key word, expect it to be a positive experience and it will be peaceful and calm. We're not going to put up with stuff that happened in other cities and states," end quote. Many storefront windows in downtown Troy were covered with plywood, some painted with colorful murals. In Albany, there have been protests almost every day, and some of the ones that lasted into the night have not turned out well. Most local media are describing a handful of troublemakers as the problem, but there have also been many reports of police aggression. The Times Union recounts one story that changed from protest to problem into police at fault. A man recording police arresting someone else on June 2nd was arrested himself and charged with inciting a riot. But Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan saw what he recorded and said it was, and I quote, "troubling," end quote. The charges against the couple were dropped June 3rd, and the matter was referred to the department's Office of Professional Standards. Kamini Anderson said he was punched by an officer and shocked with a taser. Asked why he left his car in a convenience store parking lot across the street to record the arrest, he said, and I quote, "I didn't want them to violate that man's rights in front of me. I felt that as a black man, I should stand up," end quote. He said he complied with the police request to back away, but he refused to move past his own vehicle. Sheehan said, and I quote, "The video footage does not appear to depict efforts by police to de-escalate a situation, nor does it depict the sensitivity I expect from all city employees in this moment and every day," end quote. Addison said that at one point, an officer kneeled on his head or neck for several seconds, and that he and Desiree Schumann were both taken to Albany Medical Center for treatment and released. Addison said, and I quote, "I hope they had body cameras on because I want people to hear what was said," end quote. Bill Williams is reporting for Columbia Green Media. Residents of Cooksackie and New Baltimore were affected by a water main break June 3rd, according to Cooksackie Village Mayor Mark Evans. The broken main serves a portion of Dieter Rich's trailer park and all of Scheller Park in New Baltimore, Evans said. The line is owned by the town of Baltimore but maintained by the village of Cooksackie. Evans said Callahan Construction of South Bethlehem will do the repairs because the job is beyond the ability of the village Department of Public Works to tackle. The repairs are made more difficult because the main runs under the southbound lanes of the New York State Thruway. Depending on how quickly the specific location of the break can be found, repairs could take one day or several days. The village website reports that two water trailers are available for residents of Scheller Park on Wednesday, June 3rd. Residents are being advised to boil water for use. On Thursday, a water tanker will be hooked up to the water system in Scheller in an effort to restore water service. Service to Diederich's trailer park has already been restored, but a boil water advisory is in effect for the next several days. And you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Hudson Hall announced June 3rd in a press release it is working to source bulk personal protective equipment items for the Hudson business community, including nonprofits, at cost. Items include face shields, masks, infrared thermometers, locally made hand sanitizer, and wipes. Other items will be added to the list based on demand. Supply for all items is on a first-come, first-served basis to the Hudson Business Coalition community and small businesses located within the 12534 zip code. Orders are being taken online at hudsonhall.org with curbside pickup at 327 Warren Street. The initiative is supported by the Hudson Business Coalition and the Columbia County Economic Development Corporation. Information is available at hudsonhall.com. MidHudsonNews.com is reporting the chief of the Washington Heights Fire Department in Wallkill, Ulster County, has been removed from duty following remarks he posted on his personal Facebook page. Chuck Healy called protesters, and I quote, "pavement apes," end quote, a comment the fire department said, according to a post on their Facebook page, was, and I quote, "insensitive and inappropriate at a time when all people should be unified against hate and discrimination," end quote. The post went on to say the members of the fire department are embarrassed about the comment and assured the community that Healy's remarks do not reflect the views of the Washington Heights firefighters. Healy was removed from duty while the department reviews its disciplinary options with their attorneys. And you can read the full story at MidHudsonNews.com. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, and COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Thursday, June 4th. It is a little muggy this morning as temperatures start out at 62 degrees. Expect some patchy fog. Temperatures will climb quickly to 86 at 4 p.m. Light breeze should keep the air from getting stagnant. Overnight, temperatures reach a comfortable 75 degrees by 11 p.m. It then bottoms out around dawn, reaching 63 degrees. Chances of rain enter the area after 9 a.m. At about 2 p.m. tomorrow, temperatures reach their max of 87, and rain and thunder chances increase, with these conditions lasting through dark. And Saturday's prospects are looking moist. Pollen is at medium high levels today and high levels predicted for tomorrow. The next high tides will be at 2:28 p.m. and tomorrow at 2:52 a.m. The next low tides will be at 8:50 a.m. and at 8:59 p.m. Water temperature today will be 73 degrees. Sunset today will be at 8:07 p.m. And sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:19 a.m. Looking way up, we see four near-Earth objects are expected today, the largest of which is 339 meters wide. Solar wind speed is currently 310 kilometers per second at 11 protons per milliliter. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 2, quiet. The current sunspot number is 12. And for more from the makers, tonight we will have a live correspondent attending the protest at the Catskill High School, so tune in for more. This has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Mark Pollock of Climax New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
You know, I was listening to the radio, and I heard this thing!
90.7 FM. Listener-aided and abetted radio.
Man hath an issue out of his flesh. Because of his issue, he is unclean. Every bed whereon he lieth is unclean. Everything whereon he sitteth unclean. And whosoever touches his bed shall be unclean. And he that sitteth whereon he sat shall be unclean. And he that touches the flesh of the unclean becomes unclean. He that be spat on by him unclean. Become!
The prequel to those novels. It's
absolutely
kind of eerie.
Absolutely.
It's playing out kind of almost exactly the way it was sketched. And, you know, in the novels, I left it a little bit vague about exactly what had happened to the USA. I mean, I gave people enough information to paint
to
a picture
sort it
in
all
their
out.
Minds.
Right.
But,
yeah,
you know, it's very similar to the scenario that I was spinning out, and it's eerie.
Well, I'm waiting for the oil prices did go down, right? And
well,
there was,
the oil prices have gone down a lot, and the oil scene is confusing to many people, I must say.
And that's one of your big themes, right? The whole notion of peak oil.
Yeah.
Could you explain
and, you know,
that?
For the last 10 years, the shale oil miracle, so-called, has kind of saved America's bacon. But it was built on a base of basically financial finagling and near zero lending. And the problem is that they mostly never made a red cent producing shale oil, and they did it with an enormous amount of borrowed money. And now that they've spent 10 years proving that they can't make any money, they're not going to get new lending to continue their operations. And that's the catch there.
I see.
So, you know, we're going to have problems with oil, but you know, there's a particular blogger I follow, and she's been on the scene for almost 15 years or so. She started as an editor of the now defunct website called The Oil Drum. Her name is Gail Tverberg. And, you know, she's a very proper lady of a certain age who worked as an actuary in her professional life. And that means an actuary is somebody who measures and balances risks and percentages and statistics to figure out, you know, insurance rates and stuff like that. But she's been working on the oil scene for quite a few years. And one of her main ideas is that even when we get into trouble with the oil supply, the prices are liable to go down rather than up. And that has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, it will happen in an economy where so many people are going broke so fast that the demand will simply not be there for whatever oil does come out of the ground. So it's a scene that's fraught with paradoxes and strange kind of emergent nonlinear behavior. And, you know, right now we have a lot of oil right now, but the rig count is going way down. And as the prices stay low, the shale producers are going to go bankrupt and there's going to be less oil again. It was a magnificent stunt. As a financial stunt, you know, we went from four plus almost 5 million barrels a day in 2008 to 13 million barrels a day in 2019. And that surpassed by 3 million barrels a day, the prior peak from 1970. So it was a incredible production stunt, but it was a stunt. And now, you know, it's going to turn out to have been an unfortunate fake out. And a lot of people are going to be disappointed about the, you know, the economic carnage that's left in the wake of that.
And you think that mainly affects how the supply chain, how we travel?
It affects everything because, you know, oil is involved with just about
everything.
Every product and every activity that we do.
And when you say oil, you don't just mean oil, you mean petroleum as well, right?
You're quite right, exactly. Because, you know, it involves making plastics,
right.
And making lubricants. It's not just fuel.
Fuel injection moldings and all that. Yep.
All kinds of, you know, everything at every stage along the way is going to be affected in one way or another. Cece, you're going on quite a journey.
I'm at work. I mean, there's back rooms. This is our office, our storefront.
Oh.
You know.
Yeah, our listeners are really going to enjoy that, Cece.
I've seen the store.
Yeah.
From the outside.
Yeah.
Anyway, the pandemic in a way just kind of exaggerates a lot of the things that have already been happening, right? I mean,
well, it really supercharged and accelerated trends that were already underway really badly. And there was already quite a bit of disorder in the financial markets going back to the end of last summer. You know, there was all this strange behavior in what's called the repo markets. And the repo market's a very esoteric kind of thing, it seems like. But it's just the overnight lending between large institutions to help them cover their flows of capital.
Mm-hmm.
And
Those
markets seized up in early September. And then the Federal Reserve started pouring tens of billions and then hundreds of billions of dollars into them. And, you know, it continued from September till January. Or beyond January, it was still going on when the COVID-19 virus hit. So there were already serious dislocations in the financial markets. And, you know, now that the virus has happened and the supply lines are kind of getting janky and production has stopped in a lot of places, things are getting pretty serious.
What about the fracking? Is it going to affect all of the fracking that has been done from Canada to all over, actually, even Puerto Rico, as far as Puerto Rico?
Do you mean the oil fracking?
Yeah.
Well, the oil fracking is mainly taking place in Texas and North Dakota in the USA. And yeah, it's affecting it hugely because when the price of oil went down, and it went down pretty severely to, you know, under $20 a barrel. We haven't seen a $20 a barrel
right.
for 20 years.
Right.
And they can't make a cent doing it. And a number of the big shale oil producers started to go into bankruptcy. So, yeah, you can see it in what's called the rig count, which means the number of drilling rigs that are deployed to do this. And
the rig counts. That's
it. And when the rig count falls, it means that somebody doesn't have enough money to continue drilling.
So this is also affecting, trickling down to families that depend on the men going out on these rigs to support.
Yeah, and they're
families.
Very high-priced jobs.
Yeah.
They're dangerous
jobs that have, you know, there a lot of them are union jobs. A lot they're jobs that have high salaries and benefits and all kinds of things. And So thousands of people in Texas are going to be unemployed as a result of this.
The other consequences, of course, sort of go back to your work as early as Geography of Nowhere, and you know the notion that you know the development of the past almost 100 years now, not so much just 50 or 70, well, more like 70, where we developed this suburban landscape that fails us in so many ways in terms of our access to things, and you know, and it's completely car dependent.
Yeah, it was already really unsatisfactory even when it was working at its optimum level. You know,
right.
it alienated people. It made family life crazy. It had all kinds of terrible side effects that we didn't reckon. You know, I think I said this when I gave a talk about a year ago in Hudson at
yes,
the library.
You did. We were both there.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you know, one of the things points I tried to make was that you know, I have this new theory of history that things happen because they seem like a good idea at the time. And suburbia seemed like a good idea at the time. We had a lot of good reasons for doing it. But unfortunately, times change, and then it's not such a good reason anymore. And also, you know, there's a lot of blowback sometimes from making decisions, you know, especially big decisions about how you arrange stuff in life. And that living arrangement has proved to be real problematical. And now it's being really pushed to the edge by all the trouble we're having with social distancing and people going bankrupt. And, you know, essentially, suburbia has three destinies, and they're not necessarily separate. One would be slums. Secondly would be ruins. And the third would be salvage for material.
Yeah. it is that. That does seem like the future. You know,
all three of those topics are playing out in your books, from World Made by Hand to the Witch of Hebron and to the Spring of the Horrors, Harrows of Spring, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I was a little concerned at first because
I was trying to disable my phone.
I was saying that all three scenarios have come to play out in your books.
Yeah, in the World Made by Hand books, these guys are often moving through the landscape, and they're going from town to suburb to countryside, and you see the transitions in what's happened to these places. But, you know, there are some other really enormous changes that are underway now, and they've happened very suddenly, and they're going to produce really startling changes in America. You know, one is that people have been stuck in the cities, and I'm thinking especially, you know, because it's nearby, of New York City, for the last 3 months. And a lot of people are bailing out.
Yep. You know, we see it here in Hudson already.
That migration is heavy.
Are you seeing people attempting to buy or rent property and get out?
Yes.
The property, the price of the market, if you look back 3 months ago and you were to do a Zillow of Columbia County, you'd find dots all over. Those dots are disappearing, my friend.
Yeah, that, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
My literary agent moved from the lease on his apartment was up. He moved from Manhattan to Provincetown and Cape Cod.
Wow.
Lock, stock, and barrel.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of hard to be a New York literary agent outside of New York, but he's going to do it.
Yeah, we actually have quite a few here in Hudson, believe it or not.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Of course, you know,
so
we have that
to get in and out.
We have that, right, exactly. We have the advantage of the train going right into the city.
Yeah, we have that Amtrak line. That's right.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this a little bit later, I think, and maybe a few minutes from now. But, you know, Hudson has many advantages that other towns don't have.
I think so. But, and you see it with the weekend people who are now, you know, they're isolating up here as well. And maybe won't go back. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think as a general principle, you're going to see this, is that, you know, city life is, the cities are going to contract. They're going to get smaller. And, you know, and they're going to lose a lot of their tax base. And as that happens, they're going to enter kind of a spiral of not being able to take care of their infrastructure, you know, look, New York City was having a hard time taking care of the subway, even at the height of the financialization of the economy, you know, 2-3 years ago, when nobody saw any trouble on the horizon. And the financialization of the economy, by the way, had a tremendous effect on New York City, because they basically, you know, Wall Street was asset stripping all the rest of America and sending all that wealth into New York City. And it was being expressed as, you know, a lot of janky old skeezy neighborhoods being gentrified.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You turn into housing for hedge funders, right? The Lower East Side, the Meatpacking District, much of Brooklyn, et cetera.
The Dumbo, that's right, downtown Brooklyn, all that area. Yep. Yeah.
Or foreign investors.
You know, that was what happened with financialization, but that's beginning to now go into reverse. And the cities are going to have a very hard time maintaining their infrastructures. And, you know, the suburbs are a rather poor alternative. So the way I see things, and I've actually seen this for a while looking ahead, you know, I think the small towns in America are the places that are going to be most advantaged by the changes ahead. And especially the places that are on the inland waterway system, and especially the places that are on rail lines, and especially the places that have some meaningful relationship with farming and food production and that kind of stuff.
So for our listeners, we're talking to James Howard Kunstler, and you know, he's been called a misanthrope and a Jeremiah, but he's just announced some really great things that are going to happen. The move.
That ain't fair.
You know, you don't think so? That's what I just.
No, I'm a cheerful guy. You know,
yes,
I'm just
is.
Looking at changes that are coming. Yeah. And actually, in some ways, the four novels I wrote about the future, set in a small town upstate New York, you know, they're quite a contrast of both, you know, the harshness of the life that we're moving into, and the eternal joys of being a human being on this planet.
Well, that's what's usually true about so-called Jeremiahs. Everybody, you know, I remember when Christopher Lash was real popular and everybody's like, oh, he's just negative, negative, negative. But no, he had real ideas about how to improve and, you know, hopeful things. And you do too. That was my point, really.
Well, we're going to have to do, we're going to have to do a lot. You know, there's so much to be done. You know, when it really gets down to it, we don't have a lot of time for complaining and hand-wringing and moaning and groaning.
You haven't met Cece up close.
Well,
she must be busy.
But there's so much to do.
I only moan and groan when Tom's in the picture. I got to tell you, that's it. There is a lot to do. And I got to tell you, to me, what made me think about you even more so is when you go into your local Tractor and Supply, and if you guys don't know what that is, it's just like a farm store, right?
Duh.
People who have animals.
Duh.
And you go in there, and in spring, you don't know who our audience is. We got to be clear here,
right?
You know, you go into that store and you can buy chicks in that store. You can buy animal feed in that store, not just for chickens and dogs, but also for horses and sheep and all that. So you go in there in spring and they'd have chickens, chicks, baby chicks around till like June, sometimes July. They'd have them almost ready to get out of the thing, you know, and you go in now and they're gone.
Yeah, they were gone. I noticed the same thing here. I was going to get a couple, but I bought some pullets from a lady who had like eight-week-old ones. And
that's because
I just didn't have any place to put the chicks for the period when they can't really be outside, you know.
Right.
But the little ones, they're doing fine now. And, you know, they're about 12 or 14 weeks old now. And they're
how many did you get?
I got two new ones. I had four old ones, and I was down to two old ones. You know, I got a household here with two people in it, and we don't eat that many eggs. And four chickens, we're going to be producing more eggs than we
you get. You get about 9 eggs a day with four chickens.
Oh, not that many. Not that
I
many.
Do.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, well, we do organic, plus we also give them rice and beans, and we let them, you know, we leave them cage-free a lot. So we were getting, you know, we get up to 9 eggs a day from those girls.
You must be giving them taco sauce, too.
It's called jerk seasoning, Jamaican jerk seasoning.
Yeah. Yeah.
And don't forget
give mine wasabi. See, that perks them up a little.
And she's got 7 mouths to feed besides herself and husband.
Oh, gosh.
Or partner, I should say. Now, I like to work that into every show to remind everybody that
he likes to remind people.
That's,
but, you know, I know your daughter's going. Did you know that Tom's daughter is all following in my footsteps?
Yeah, she's on.
I went from
is
one
she opening
to three.
A store?
No, she's
I
had
went
her
from
third
one
child.
To three overnight. Yeah.
She had twins.
She had twins.
Yeah, she had
she
twins
had
recently.
Wow.
So now she's
well,
up to
remember
three
what Groucho said? That you know, remember what Groucho said on his quiz show?
No.
Well, he had this quiz show in like 1955. Yeah. You bet your life,
right.
Groucho Marx.
I'll tell you about it for tomorrow.
And, so he had this lady on, and, you know, she was a contestant. And he said, what are you doing? And she said, well, I'm a housewife, Groucho. I've got 10 children. And Groucho said, oh, I like my cigar, too, but I take it out once in a while.
Oh!
Yeah.
So CBS kicked him off the air for 2 weeks.
Yeah. 2 weeks is mild. That's a tap on the hand.
Yeah, it was kind of.
Because probably half the audience didn't get it anyway.
Good thing you had some money in the bank.
Yeah. So
for we had our financial analyst on a couple weeks ago, didn't we, Tom?
Yes, we did.
Talking about the Wall Street and, you know, investments and, you know, the reality of what it looks like to invest right now. You know, a lot of people are thinking not to invest because if there's an economic downturn, is anything going to be worth anything? Even the dollar, the U.S. dollar with all the stimulus, that's the question. Is the money going to be of value? Is it going to be worth anything?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And all of these factors are kind of revolving around each other in a dynamic relationship that could cause a lot of trouble. Like, you're right. You know, we don't know what's going to happen to the dollar with all of this Federal Reserve activity and money printing. And, you know, we can see that the effect of it at the moment is it's, you know, jacking up the stock market and juicing the stock market.
That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, the stock market's doing pretty well. And that,
well, the stock market went up 500 points yesterday when there were, you know, riots and looting in 17
cities. It was crazy. Right. It was crazy.
Well, how do you feel, James, about that issue of, you know, measuring the economy by the stock market? Isn't that kind of false?
It's insane.
It really is insane, right?
Tom. Right. Look, we haven't had unemployment like this since, you know, even in the Depression, it wasn't this bad.
That's right.
You know, it's incredible how much damage has been done to people's livelihoods and careers and incomes and families and households. It's just stupendous. And, you know, I think the country's in shock. And obviously, the federal government giving out a lot of extra unemployment money has cushioned it somewhat. But how long is that going to go on? And if it goes on indefinitely and you have a whole nation full of people who are getting paid for doing nothing.
Exactly.
You know, what are we going to produce? You know, and
exactly.
What is the money going to be worth? And so, yeah, you know, the stock market can go up to 50,000 points, but the dollar can be worthless when that happens. So
do you think a work program?
That's a theme in his book, Tom.
Yeah. Do you think a work program is in order?
Well, I'm not sure that it would help that much for the numbers of people that are out. But, you know, it would certainly be, I think, a good move for government to attempt something like that. But, you know, I don't know if we're the same kind of country that can do that, that did it in 1934.
What's a work program? Give me an example. What
you know, just building roads and WPA.
Like the programs in the Depression where they went doing public works, building dams, building trails in the national parks, you know, fixing stuff up, having arts projects, all kinds of things. I'm sure the government can and probably will do that. But, you know, if there are 50 million people out of the workforce and they put 2.5 million out of work, here's the thing I was going to say a second ago. You know, if the stock market keeps on going up every day for months and the rest of America is going broke, you know, you're going to see a much worse revolution than what we had in the streets this week, which was already pretty bad.
Yeah.
But I mean, imagine how resentful people are going to feel about that. You know, they're going to be burning down the big bank buildings on Wall Street if that happens. So, you know, I mean, I don't know what they, quotation marks, can do about it. If they stopped the money printing, you know, the stock market would go down. If they stopped jamming money into the banks, the stock market would go down. But if they stop jamming money in any way into the economy, you know, then everything could go down. So we're in a very kind of liminal moment right now where we don't know where this is going and how bad it's going to be. And all the signs are showing that it's going to probably be pretty harsh going forward. Just, you know, everything you can imagine in everyday life is not working. Mm-hmm. You know, people are not going to restaurants. People are not going to ball games. People are not going to concerts. People are not running their businesses. They're not producing anything. They're not doing any services. You know, I mean, everything from the acupuncturist to the orthodontist, you know, they're all down. Well, when they come back, me too.
I have a problem. You don't, but you do actually.
I'm starting to look like a werewolf in my own way. I could use a haircut. So, you know, that's what we're looking at. And in the meantime, you know, we got a lot of distractions going on. Yeah. And this society is having an awful hard time getting its head screwed on right.
So,
you know, while it's getting punched in the head.
Right. And you've outlined some of the, you know, the severe problems and the possibilities. And I guess we can talk about Hudson now, because you're suggesting that we're pretty well positioned here in Hudson for some of the things that are going to happen in the future.
Yeah, I think you are.
Because of our closeness to food production, for one thing, mm-hmm. and also our access to the river, to the train system. And who knows, maybe they'd bring back the old trains. I mean, you look at those old maps. I think you did this at one of the presentation I saw, or maybe someone else, looking at the old map, railroad map of this part of the world.
Yeah.
And it's phenomenal.
Yeah, it was very rich and fine-grained, and it went to every little burg in the Hudson Valley, including mine, which has a decommissioned railroad system that went to several places, and you know, a lot of different lines passed through it. Mm-hmm. And there's very little left but kind of the ruins of the marshalling yard and the, you know, a few of the station things. But look, we, as I've said in public appearances, unfortunately, we missed the boat on high speed rail. We missed the train on high speed rail. That happened in other countries when there was still a lot of capital around. Okay. Mm-hmm. And now that we're moving into a period of relative capital scarcity, which means money scarcity, we don't have the mojo to build a high-speed rail system, and on top of the other problems that that are entailed by it, like the fact that you have to, you know, that you can't run the high-speed rail on the old rail lines because they have different curve ratios and grade ratios. You'd have to condemn an awful lot of land in order mm-hmm. to get a new right-of-way. But the thing is, we had a wonderful state-of-the-art railroad system in this country, you know, in the 1940s, and we just let it go. And people would be delighted if we could get that running again and mm-hmm. running well. You know, if the trains ran on time and left the station on time and got to the station on time, and if the stations were decent stations, you know, if they weren't didn't look like Soviet lunch counters. Which is how we've been doing it for the last 30 years. And people would be delighted to go from Hudson to Chicago at 100 miles an hour, mm-hmm. Which was a state of the art in 1920. But now our trains, you know, they probably average 40 miles an hour going to Chicago. And that's a project that we could do. You know, we know how to do rail. It's not rocket science. We could actually have a federal program that would put people to work doing it. And we're going to need it desperately because the motoring system is going down.
Yeah.
You know, the car system, this is something that we might talk about a little, because the whole automobile system, which is a matrix of subsystems, is kind of falling apart. You know, it requires...
In what way? Because I still see cars churning out every year. What is it? 70,000 cars between all the models come out a year? 70,000 cars?
Well, no, in America, in the United States, the U.S. producers have been selling about 17 million units a year. That's a lot of cars.
Yeah.
And right now, nobody's buying cars. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, people might have thought that the car system, the motoring system, the private transportation system would get into trouble because of the gasoline issue or the oil mm-hmm. issue. But in fact, it's getting into trouble for a whole other reason.
Yes.
Americans are used to buying cars on installment loans, and nobody can qualify for a loan anymore. Mm. You know, and also we're moving into this period of capital scarcity where there's going to be less money to lend to people and fewer qualified borrowers. And so the bottom line is Detroit, or wherever they come from now, is going to sell far fewer cars than they're used to selling. And then you have to ask yourself, you know, a company like Ford or General Motors is set up to sell, you know, 4, 5, 6 million units a year. You know, they're not going to survive just making 800,000 cars a year or 60,000 mm-hmm. cars a year, whatever it turns out to be, you know. So you got to ask yourself, A, are the automobile companies going to stay in business or are they going to go bankrupt? B, how are Americans going to buy cars if they're all broke? And C, if all the municipalities are broke and their tax revenues are going down to nothing, how are they going to maintain this elaborate hierarchy of roadways that we have going from back alleys to the four-lane interstates and everything in between. You know, just the amount of maintenance that is required to do that has probably taken the bulk of the municipal budgets for the last 50 years. And if the money's not there, you know, our roads aren't going to be working.
Right.
So the whole system is really in trouble. We're going to have to rebuild the railroad system. It's much easier to rebuild the railroad system than it will be to probably save the motoring system. We're not going to save it by electrifying the car fleet.
That was my next question. Yeah.
That's a fantasy.
Yeah. It's,
you know, you can prove that you can look, we've demonstrated we can build electric cars, and they're real good electric cars. But if you don't have a population that's able to buy them one way or another, either on installment loans or any other way, you know, that ain't going to happen. And, you know, we're not ready for self-driving cars that, you know, would just float around like taxi cabs. You know, that's sort of a fantasy at this point. So I think that the reality-based system is we better get ready for, you know, to fix the train system.
Well, we're talking to James Howard Kunstler. His latest book is Living in the Long Emergency from Ben Bella Books.
Yeah.
A fairly new publisher out there.
They've been around for about 15 or 20 years. And, you know, they're all right. I've had, I've enjoyed working with them. They've been very professional.
And
I, you know, by the way, you know, it's of all, you know, all the activities we've already talked about, we have no idea what's going to be happening to the publishing industry, which has been a big part of New York City and the Hudson Valley and, you know, Hudson, New York.
And you've,
you know,
you've
a lot of writers, a lot of agents,
you've already bemoaned
and editors.
You've already bemoaned the sort of decline in the whole publishing world.
Yeah.
For so many reasons. I mean, that, you know, I mean, I think one of the things I read was it's harder, and of course now the pandemic even makes it harder to get out and promote books. And apparently you've had you used to be able to book a lot of university appearances.
Oh yeah, and well that's over with.
That's over
for now.
For now.
Yeah,
but it's a much harder struggle to live fully off of one's writing.
Oh yeah, I was going to come down to the Spotty Dog sometime in May. I was already scheduled.
Oh,
my
really?
Book came out in March. And that was canceled. And, you know, all the book appearances in Manchester and Albany and, you know.
But it is a perfect title for the Times.
Well, the book came out almost literally the day that the long emergency started in earnest. You know, it was published on like March 10th. And that's when, you know, people started getting, you know, losing their jobs by the gobs. So, things are happening now in a way that may end up being quite permanent. I'm not sure that a lot of our arrangements and familiar comforts and conveniences are coming back the way that we, you know, used to have them. And we're not ready for that. You know, it's been a beautiful spring now, and everybody's been kind of exhilarated just by the weather alone. But, you know, as the summer goes on and, you know, people can't even afford to pay their electric bill and they don't have air conditioning and, you know, who knows, maybe there's another wave of the virus, people get sick again. You know, where things are looking a little bit sketchy out there.
Do you feel?
Let me ask you what? Oh,
go ahead.
Well, let me go ladies first, right?
Yes.
Go ahead, Tom, ladies first.
Okay, I will. Do you feel sometimes like reality is outpacing you in terms of, you know, a lot of your fiction as well as some of your nonfiction is based
well
in...
it's going at a good rate of speed, that's for sure. You know, I think we're going neck and neck so far. took a while for me to catch up. You know, I thought these things were going to happen a little bit sooner after 2005 when the original Long Emergency book was published. Mm-hmm. And then we had that 10-year period after the crash in Wall Street and the whole mortgage fiasco. We had these 10 years of basically borrowing a lot of money to pay for the stuff that we were running for the last 10 years. So we created this horrible debt problem that we're in, and we borrowed all this money from the future and from our children's and grandchildren's future to run all of our stuff from 2005 to 2020. And now we're stuck.
I still see, but I don't want my voice to work.
And it remains to be seen whether we can even generate, you know, real money. You know, that's a problem with the whole money printing thing with the Federal Reserve. You have to ask yourself after a while, is it money or is it some kind of phantom money?
Yeah. Right.
You know, I'm not sure that, you know, it's what it pretends to be. And something's propping it up right now, but, you know,
it ain't gold.
It's not. Right. And, you know, we're already beginning to see things like prices going up sharply in the supermarkets.
Oh, yeah.
What are you seeing in the food prices in the food business?
I got to tell you, we're seeing prices more. I mean, first of all, they talk about rice. Rice hasn't been this high since before the 60s, right? And rice is like a staple, you know?
Sure.
Produce is actually leveled off. It hasn't increased. It hasn't gotten crazy. But other things, meat, dairy, all that stuff, snacks, all those things have gone up. Did you call? Sorry. Hold on, guys.
Well, I'm not surprised to hear that. And from what I see in the supermarket, you know, our local supermarket in my little flyover town of Greenwich, which is about 50-odd miles north of you guys, you know, our supermarket, Hannaford, is starting to look like a kind of a Soviet supermarket.
Yeah.
You go down an aisle and that whole aisle is like, doesn't have anything on the shelves. And, you know, the meat department, things are kind of strewn about in the display racks in a way that they weren't before. Like someone just kind of tossed them out there, like they fell off a truck or something right into the rack.
Yeah.
It's getting kind of weird.
It is. Down at Rolling Grocer, our last shipment of toilet paper was truly out of the Soviet playbook. It was this weird sort
of... Was it like old newspaper?
Yeah, it was almost like old... Right, with newspaper with no print on it. It was just, yeah, oh my God.
Did they get it from like Kazakhstan or something?
That was really...
I don't know. We could make that stuff around here. Yeah. There was a factory that made toilet paper right up here in Greenwich. We had like 5 paper mills.
Yeah, we had a paper mill not far from here too.
And the last incarnation of one of them was toilet paper.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of a sad metaphor for the demise of industry in our little corner of the world.
How are things otherwise in terms of... you know, spirits, we talked about spirits being up and like local officials and how they're keeping things at peace within each town. Because you're like, are you Schoharie or are you Washington?
We're Washington County.
Okay.
And you know, I think the public's pretty demoralized. This was a pretty beat up, economically beat up flyover town, even well before COVID-19 hit. You know, it lost its industry in the 1970s. And the people who are still here, I think quite a big slice of them are demoralized and discouraged and broke and really suffering. The farmers have had a hard time. You know, dairy farming has been kind of going out because they couldn't compete with the Midwest and the California cheesemakers and all, you know, right. All that faraway stuff. And their kids didn't want to take over the farm.
We have been
converting the dairy farms into new kinds of farms, you know, that sell like table greens at the farmer's market and stuff to the restaurants and boutique meat operations, like, you know, boutique pork and lamb operations. So that's been going on, ongoing for about 15, 20 years up here. But I think that's going to accelerate. And I wouldn't be surprised if people will be surprised at how much agriculture comes back to the center of our economic life in some parts of the country.
You mean a world made by hand, you mean?
Well, yeah, pretty much, you know.
The farmers locally have the one, you know, this is a national picture too. The farmers who are dependent on, you know, supplying fast food chains and all that are suffering, but the local farmers are doing quite fine. And the ones who even had exclusives with restaurants they had an ability to adapt very easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Somewhat. The workforce is still pretty stagnant and still pretty poor. And I feel like the government should be, you know, initializing some type of a penalty for not trying to find something that's readily available. And now, because I mean, I created a Facebook group called the City of Hudson Help Wanted. And I looked on yesterday, there were over 15 jobs, welding, farm work. I mean, so many farms need help, need hands. And it's like, where are the people? Where are they?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we may have gone through such a long period of people losing their skills that the people don't have the skills anymore.
Yeah.
I've heard people complain about it up here that they want to hire somebody who's got, like, you know, the guy who fixes my car. He had a really hard time finding a competent mechanic to work him in the shop, and that went on for months. So
we've had that here with the construction business. Mm-hmm. Very hard to find people trained or willing to be trained, even, which you'd think that would be, you know, like, you know, I mean, I guess a lot of people, you know, I've always been puzzled by this. You know, it's partly when you see the kind of salaries in popular culture and all that kind of thing and the hedge fund guys. And then you expect somebody to say, oh, yeah, I'm happy to be trained at $12 an hour so that someday I can make 20 or maybe even 25. Yeah.
But, you know, the thing is, it's not just about that. You know what I mean? Because it's also about this thing that happened, which is called TV and keeping up with the Joneses. I remember when my mother used to watch Lifetimes of the Rich and Famous. Do you remember?
Oh, like you didn't watch it? Who are you kidding?
I don't remember your mama, but I remember the Lifetimes of the Rich and Famous.
It was like you got to see things that you never thought of. Movie theaters in people's homes. It got to be crazy. And now it's been replaced by MTV Cribs and all these other things that have come in place. And now people, there's nobody glorifying working with hands. There's nobody glorifying that.
Yeah.
And so there's a little bit of brainwashing with that. And then there's also the other reality that the value of money, again, what is it really worth? What is it going to buy you? I mean, yeah, there's some independence with being a self-employed person, but I mean.
Hey, Jim, what do you think of universal basic income idea?
I'm not that hot on it. I don't think it's a good idea to train or condition or program a whole nation of people to just be on the dole. Mm. I think it would be a bad idea.
We have it happening in Hudson here, Jim. Tell them about it, Tom.
Andrew Yang is sponsoring a sort of little pilot program here in Hudson.
Yeah.
Where they're going to provide a basic income to 20, obviously it's not universal, but to 20 people. And they're going to monitor it closely. I don't know. It's just, who knows?
Yeah, well, you know, anybody's free to give their money away.
You're right about that.
But, yeah, I want to get to something that we touched on a little bit before the just before the show when we were just chatting. And that is, you know, Hudson does have some real advantages when, you know, how and when it will resolve about where people are going to choose to live. You know, Americans are still going to be going places and wanting to go on journeys out, away from where they live.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Hudson Valley has a lot of value for that. And it's not far away from the population centers. And so I think that Hudson will have a lot of value for people who just want to, you know, go away for a weekend, and they're not going to be going to France or Italy or Argentina anymore or Hawaii, but they may be coming up to Hudson. And, you know, I think in general, we're looking at a much smaller scale of everyday life, including the range of travel that people do. So,
and there's another industry that's going to be devastated, right? I mean, the airlines are just suffering.
They're toast. Yeah, there was an article in the paper today. I don't know if it was the Times. It was on the net, I guess, but it said something like the U.S. airlines had increased their the amount of flying that they were going to do to 15% of what it used to be.
Wow!
And that's going up from where they've been, which is lower than that.
Wow!
So you know that tells you that, and you know, they're discontinuing service to many kind of small to mid-size airports. And, you know, I don't think that industry is going to be what it used to be. And the fall off from it is going to be really sharp, and it already is, and kind of catastrophic for that industry and the ones that are related to it. But, you know, you told me earlier that you still have some redevelopment is continuing to occur.
It is. And for the very reasons you noticed, I mean, the access still to New York City and other parts of the planet, or at least on the rail track, on the railway between Albany and New York. I mean, we're right there. Secondly, we're right on the river.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I have a friend who works for NYPA, the New York What does it stand? Anyway, she is involved in a project with reimagining what happens on the Erie Canal. So I have a feeling there's people in Albany who might be thinking about the very thing we were talking about. In terms
I don't think there's any question that we're going to have to move more products by boat.
Yeah.
You know, because the trucking industry is going to get into trouble, too, sooner or later. It already is, but not at the scale that could really put it down for good. But the time is going to come when the trucking industry is going to be in kind of terminal condition. And we're going to have to move more stuff on boats and on rail. And maybe the final journey from the depot to the retailer will be by truck. Mm-hmm. But, you know, long distance trucking is going to be a thing of the past. And most people can't even imagine a world without it. But we're going to be getting there, and we may be getting there within the next, you know, 10 years or so. So that's something to get ready for.
But back to your question, Hudson is seeing development, and there's a lot of the real estate market, I'm told, is hopped up here, and people are buying here, and there's a hotel project. There's actually two potential hotel projects. So who knows? Maybe we'll benefit. And it's, as you point out, partly because we're on the train, and also we are fortunate to be surrounded by phenomenal agriculture. And I hope they don't screw that
up. There's another thing that Hudson has for itself that is obvious when you think about it, and obvious when you're walking down the street, but I don't think people credit it enough. And that is that it's truly one of the few places in America that is a charming place to be. And what's happened in the last 50 years in America is we've had this catastrophic loss of any attempt to create artistry in our everyday surroundings. And by that, I don't mean artworks. I don't mean sculpture and paintings and murals. I mean just the normal charm that comes from designing towns and buildings correctly and doing it with some understanding of how that works.
Yeah.
And Hudson has a great deal of authentic charm. And, you know, it's a place that feels immediately comfortable when you get here, when you walk down Warren Street. And that in itself is an enormous advantage, because there are plenty of towns out there that have just committed suicide, you know, in upstate New York. And they've not only lost their economy, but they've managed to knock down everything of spiritual and artistic worth in them.
I was talking to somebody from Amsterdam, who's Amsterdam, New York.
Oh, my God.
Who said it was once a beautiful place with a lot of similar...
Amsterdam was unquestionably a beautiful Mohawk River town and a very wealthy town. The Mohawk carpet mills were there, and they had, you know, this tremendous industry. And they knocked down about, I don't know, 60% of the downtown in order to create what they called at the time in the 70s an urban mall. And it, you know, the problem was it landed in Amsterdam like a UFO. But when those UFOs land, they don't fly away. You know, they stay there and they become, you know, derelict ruins of UFOs. And that's exactly what happened.
I get into that argument all the time about Albany. With people who like that UFO section there.
The Empire State Plaza is a curious thing. When you look at it, you have to remember that, first of all, the thing is an abstraction.
Yeah.
It's not really an urban form. It's like a sculpture. And Nelson Rockefeller, bless his heart, I guess, was an aficionado, a connoisseur of modern art. You know? And let's face it, you know, that was the kind of thing, exactly the kind of thing that seemed like a good idea at the time. You know, let's put a big, gigantic, super scaled piece of modern art where Albany used to be, or at least where a good 10% of it used to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was supposed to look good from this brand new thing called the Interstate Highway. And it did look good. It was, you know, kind of you swoop up, you know, close to it and you see this giant egg-shaped auditorium and these towers, and the whole thing is kind of thrilling from a sculptural point of view, but it destroyed the city. It destroyed the connectivity of the streets. There's this big fortification all around it. It's like a 50-foot high wall that looks like a medieval fortress. And so, you know, it's destroyed an entire quarter of Albany, and the whole thing was a fiasco.
Yeah.
But it seemed like a good idea at the time.
There's a really good documentary about the neighborhoods that they destroyed to build that.
Yeah, the I guess it was the, I don't know, the South,
yeah,
South End, or part of the South yes. End, around Lombard Street yeah. and going down to the river. And it was really unfortunate.
Yeah, they had to call them slums in order to justify it, when in fact yeah. there was nothing slummy about them at all.
Yeah, and yeah, if they had actually rehabilitated that neighborhood, you know, yeah. it would have been as nice as Georgetown or, yeah. you know. Other great urban neighborhoods that have been revived over the decades. But, you know, they made that choice. And so Nelson Rockefeller hired the guy who designed the United Nations, a guy named Wallace K. Harrison. And he designed this abomination. And then they went out and, you know, they wanted to expand Albany State University. Mm-hmm. And they hired Edward Durrell Stone. Actually, Edward Durrell Stone had this this design for a college that he had been commissioned by Pakistan to build for Islamabad. And somehow the project got canceled. So he had this leftover project and he basically sold it to Nelson Rockefeller and said, oh, I got this plan for something that could be a college. Let's put this out there. So it has these giant colonnades, you know, and these windswept colonnades that are kind of designed to be in a hot climate where the tropical winds blow and, you know, you need to have a high ceiling and, you know. And so when you're there in February, you know, it's like the most inhospitable environment you can imagine. It's like being lost in space.
Somebody once pointed out to me that the design of SUNY Purchase was also supposed to echo the design of the University of Virginia, and I just cracked up. It was just like walking yeah. down the colonnades at UVA is nothing like walking down the colonnades at SUNY Purchase.
Well, the architects always say dumb things like that. You know, they're kind of, you know, what the graduate school in America has really destroyed American intellectual life. Because now everybody in a profession in America feels like they have to come up with a new metaphysic to explain what they're doing. And especially the architects, you know, they have to have a new theory for every new building that comes along. And often it's accompanied by a whole lot of, you know, graduate school style BS,
right?
You know, to explain it.
And, absolutely.
And so that's what you get.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking to James Howard Kunstler, the author of 14 novels, 6 books of social criticism, a blogger who you can read at kunstler.com, recently the new urbanist fellow at the American Conservative magazine. What's that about, by the way?
Well, you know, they had a writer
helping out with this
with them named Roger Scruton, yeah. who was a great English philosopher who wrote about
contrarian
urbanism and architecture and music and other things.
Everything.
He's just a wonderful writer, a fabulous writer. And he passed away, 18 months ago, yeah. 2 years ago. So they created a fellowship and, you know, to get a different writer every year to do what he used to do. And I'm this year's Scruton Fellow.
Cool.
So
this is a heavy year. This is a memorable year for you. I mean, everybody's going to remember 2020, right? Are you doing anything different from your predecessor? Are you doing anything different from your predecessor that we should know about?
No, I'm just publishing a monthly essay, you know. Yeah. And
cool.
So I guess I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, it's top of the hour, so we're going to be playing the news. But thank you for coming on. This has been great. Always
You're
a pleasure
welcome,
to talk
Tom,
to you.
CC.
Yeah. All right. Besides the WGXE afternoon show right now, we have a second live stream going up live from the protest in Catskill at the middle school, which just started a second ago. We'll hear it for a second.
Michael Brown, Alton Sterling, Botham Jean, Atiana Jefferson, Ahmed Aubrey, George Floyd, just a few who have lost their lives.
All right, that's going on live right now at WGXC.org. You can tune in if you'd like at WGXC.org or go to wavefarm.org and slash listen. It's one of the streams there. Or go to WGXC.org, any WGXC page, click on the listen button and scroll down for the Enough is Enough protest happening right now at Catskill Middle School in Catskill. Here is the news update, and then we'll be back with Tom and Cece on the WGXC Afternoon Show.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Grant. Melanie Lekasabek is reporting for Columbia Green Media. Thousands of absentee ballot applications are pouring into the Board of Elections in Columbia and Greene counties in advance of the June 23rd primary election. Governor Andrew Cuomo issued an executive order in April requiring the applications be sent to every eligible voter statewide in response to the health concerns raised by large gatherings at polling sites. Republican Commissioner Kelly Miller-Simons said the Columbia County Board of Elections mailed out 31,002 absentee ballot applications in May to both Republicans and Democrats. Completed applications have been coming in over the past few days. Once submitted, the applications are reviewed and put into the system. If eligible, a ballot is then sent to the voter. Columbia County Democratic Commissioner Ken Dow said voters looking to vote by absentee ballot in the primary race should complete and mail their applications as soon as possible. County Republican Commissioner Brent Borgata said in Greene County, the initial mailing was so daunting that officials brought in additional help to get them all out. He said, and I quote, "It is more than normal, so we have had to bring in two elections inspectors that work with us on normal election days who have information and knowledge of the process to help us process all these absentee ballot applications," end quote. He said the more than 22,000 applications to Democrats and Republicans were mailed out about 10 days ago. He added that County Board of Elections officials will process all of the applications. While all eligible voters have the option to vote by absentee ballot in the primary, Borgata said all 25 of Greene County's polling sites will be open for in-person voting from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. Columbia County will also have polling sites open, but fewer of them. Dow said there will be 13 sites open compared to 32 for a typical primary. Early voting is available and begins June 13th. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Emily Munson is reporting for the Times Union. Congress has approved new legislation to add more flexibility to the Paycheck Protection Program, a federal forgivable loan program for small businesses. The Senate unanimously passed a bill June 3rd to make changes that will allow small businesses to use their loan money to cover expenses over 24 weeks instead of 8 and still qualify for forgiveness. They also can use more of the loan for costs other than payroll, including rent. Only 60% must now cover payroll in order to get forgiveness. The bill would also allow companies that are approved for loan forgiveness to defer payroll taxes. Finally, companies that do not meet the criteria to have the loan forgiven will now have 5 years instead of 2 to pay it back. The U.S. House of Representatives approved the measure last week. The bill now goes to President Donald Trump for his signature. The Small Business Administration has approved more than 4.5 million PPP loans to small businesses totaling more than $510 billion, including nearly 300,000 loans to New York businesses as of last week. The average loan in New York was $128,531. And you can read the full story in the Times Union. MidHudsonNews.com is reporting the State Thruway Authority has resumed cash toll collections along the Thruway's ticketed system effective Thursday, June 4th. The emergency toll procedure put in place in March are now suspended. Drivers will receive a toll ticket when entering and be able to pay with cash at a staffed lane when exiting. Drivers with EasyPass will continue with contactless travel and payment at all tolling locations. And you can read the full story at MidHudsonNews.com. The New York State Department of Environmental Conservation is reporting on Tuesday, May 26, Greene County 911 requested help from state forest rangers in a search for two hikers in Hunter. A 33-year-old woman and a 65-year-old man from Brooklyn had lost the escarpment trail just past Sunset Rock in Catskill Wild Forest. GPS coordinates put the pair 100 feet off the trail. Neither had flashlights or water with them at the time. Forest Ranger Rob Dawson responded and located the hikers, gave them water, and took them back to his vehicle for transport back to their vehicle at South Lake. The search and rescue concluded at 12:40 a.m. Read more at dec.newyork.gov. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. The local weather reports, public meetings, community information, and COVID-19 updates. Visit our website at WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Wanting everyone, each one of your creation, to experience your love for them and a supernatural unity and harmony that can only come from you. We trust you, God. We love you. And it's in your name we pray. Amen.
Thank you all. Let's march.
This is the Hudson Protest live. I mean, the Catskill Protest. Excuse me. It's just leaving, apparently, the Catskill Middle School. Happening right
You're
now live in Catskill.
Right now to a live Neva Wartell live from Catskill, where the March for Justice. Is taking place.
But maybe Deb can take some
pictures. Maybe we'll come back to that in a little bit.
At the courthouse.
We'll try again.
Those are for giving out to anybody who needs them.
Okay, we'll come back to that in a little bit. There you have it. That was live from Catskill, where the March for Justice takes place. We'll try that a little again later. In the meantime, let's play a little music appropriate for the day, I guess, and the last week. Let's listen to this. Let's see how it goes. Okay, why is it not coming on? Well, I seem to once again be having trouble getting the music to play, and I don't know why. Let's see if this is it. Ah, here we go.
Girl, you got me dancing. Dancing, shake your brain. We just want to party. Party just for you. We just want the money. Money just for you. I know you want to party. Party just for me. Girl, you got me dancing. Dancing, shake your brain.
You slipping now, don't catch you slipping now, look what I'm whipping now, this is America, don't catch you slipping now, don't catch you slipping now, look what I'm whipping now, this is America, don't catch you slipping now, look how I'm living now, police be tripping now, yeah, this is America, guns in my area, I got the strap, I gotta carry them. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go into this. Yeah, yeah, this is gorilla. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go get the bag. Yeah, yeah, or I'ma get the pad. Yeah, yeah, I'm so cold like, yeah. Yeah, I'm so dull like, yeah. We gon' blow like, yeah. Slipping now, look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping up. Look how I'm geeking up. I'm so pretty. I'm on Gucci. I'm so pretty. I'm gonna get it.
contraband. Contraband, contraband, contraband. I got the plug on Oaxaca.
Whoa.
They gonna find you like Waka.
I just checked my follow and listen.
You gon' tell somebody.
You motherfuckers owe me.
Grandma told me, get your money, black man.
Black man.
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 Well, that was Childish Gambino. Look, you know, these are amazingly weird times. But the last thing I think people want to hear, talking about not the pandemic, but about the racial situation in America right now, are white people, of which I'm one. So I thought you might like this little bit, if it comes out the way it should. Let's see if this is what I'm hoping it is.
Tuesday will mark 55 years since two of America's most influential intellectuals faced off in a debate in England at Cambridge University's debating society, the Cambridge Union. It was a debate about race, one that still fascinates and resonates today and is the subject of a new book. NewsHour Weekend, Zachary Green has our story.
The trouble in America where the Negro community is concerned is
That's William Buckley, by the way.
It comes as a great shock to discover that the country which is
and
your
that's James Baldwin.
And to which you owe your life and your identity has not in its whole system of reality evolved any place for you.
On the evening of February 18th, 1965, two cultural giants, James Baldwin and William F. Buckley Jr., squared off in person for the first time. More than 50 years later, the debate still resonates. Political science professor Nicholas Bukola of Linfield College in Oregon was so taken with the skirmish that he wrote a book about it, The Fire Is Upon Us.
It just seemed to me just such a dramatic moment and such an important one, just sort of these two movements that did so much to define 20th century political history. To have these two figures clashing was just irresistible.
Though Baldwin and Buckley were about the same age, their lives could not have begun more differently. Baldwin grew up in poverty in Harlem and went from waiting tables in New York's Greenwich Village to become a literary critic and eventually a renowned novelist and essayist. Buckley, a scion of wealth, graduated from Yale and became an influential magazine editor and columnist. Both wrote extensively about race in 1950s and 60s America, though from drastically different points of view. Buckley made his position clear in a 1957 National Review piece called Why the South Must Prevail, in which he contended that white Southerners are entitled to, quote, take such measures as are necessary to prevail politically and culturally over black citizens.
And Buckley says explicitly that they have this right and duty because they are, and this is a quote, for the time being, the advanced race. And he calls on people in the South, they have an obligation to promote the cultural equality of black people and that eventually they need to allow them in empower them with full citizenship.
What did Baldwin think was at the heart of the racial divide in America?
What Baldwin said from, you know, some of his earliest writings on this is that these people are scared. Their identity is wrapped up in this idea that their whiteness is what gives them their only source of moral worth in the world. It's what gives them value in the world. Baldwin says that is an extraordinarily sad moral life that that person is leading. That is the thing they are clinging to give them a sense of meaning.
Bukola interviewed members of Cambridge University's debating society, the Cambridge Union, who were present at the 1965 debate. They said the union agreed to let Baldwin appear as part of a publicity tour for one of his books, as long as another guest challenged him on one of the themes of his writings. They ultimately invited Buckley, who accepted.
From all sides of the house,
the motion debated was this: the American dream is at the expense of the American Negro.
Good evening.
Baldwin starts his speech with this idea that we can't even begin reflecting on the moral and political questions at hand without first addressing this question of what is one system of reality.
The Mississippi or the Alabama sheriff, who really does believe when he's facing a Negro boy or girl, that this woman, this man, this child, must be insane to attack the system to which he owes his entire identity. Of course, for such a person, the proposition of which we're trying to discuss here tonight does not exist.
There's this one kind of remarkable point in the speech where Baldwin suddenly shifts from speaking in the second person to speaking in the first person.
I am stating very seriously, and this is not an overstatement, that I picked the cotton and I carried it to market and I built the railroad under someone else's whip for nothing. For nothing.
What do you think his purpose was in making this shift?
Baldwin wants to call on everyone watching that debate to recognize that white supremacy is not something in the past, it's something that's central to all of our lives, and that we are all in some sense complicit in it, and we all have a responsibility to fight back against it. And he talks about the ways in which the moral lives of white people have been destroyed by this plague called color.
No matter what disaster overtakes them, they have one enormous knowledge and consolation, which is like a heavenly revelation. At least they are not black. Now I suggest that of all the terrible things that can happen to a human being, that is one of the worst. I suggest that what has happened to white Southerners is in some ways, after all, much worse than what has happened to Negroes there.
When Baldwin ended his remarks, he received a standing ovation. Then it was Buckley's turn to take the floor.
It is impossible, in my judgment, to deal with the indictment of Mr. Baldwin unless one is prepared to deal with him as a white man.
This is a strange argument for many of us to hear, but here's what Buckley had in mind. For Buckley, part of the experience of being treated as a black person was to not have one's ideas taken seriously. And so Buckley's argument was that I will treat Baldwin as a white man. That for Buckley, that meant I will take his ideas seriously, and I will call him out for the ideas that I think are dangerous.
Buckley went on to describe what he saw as the causes of racial inequality in America.
One is the dreadful efforts to perpetuate discrimination by many individual American citizens as a result of their lack of that final and ultimate concern which some people are truly trying to agitate the other. Is as a result of the failure of the Negro community itself to make certain exertions which were made by other minority groups during the American experience.
Buckley is very careful to say there are individual white people. So it's not a collective problem. There are some bad apples out there, and that needs